I was amongst the very, very early ones to land on Gallipoli. That's on the 25th of April, of course. And it was a marvelous experience. And when we did actually land, we didn't know quite what we were going to do. We hadn't had any definite instructions that we had to take a certain knoll or a certain position. We just went ashore and we looked for Turks. It was the first time that an Australian force had been abroad as an Australian army with its own officers, as its own unit. Here we were on our own, we were Australians. And that's why Anzac to me is so important, and it's important to Australia. We became a nation the day we landed on Gallipoli. Every moment of Gallipoli is very, very vividly in my mind. Although it's a long time ago, I could recall the names of dozens of men, and yet I can meet men in the War Veterans Home here, and tomorrow morning you ask me the name and I couldn't tell you.
So they were the words spoken in 1972 by an Australian veteran that landed at Gallipoli, Anzac Cove, the 25th of April 1915, a date that has become so symbolic in the history of New Zealand and Australia that it's now known as Anzac Day and commemorated wherever Australians and New Zealanders are throughout the world. And it's that one day, 24 hours at Anzac Cove that I want to talk about this week. The landing of the Anzac troops, the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps, 4,000 men from the 1st Australian Division alone that landed in three successive waves on a front of 2,000 yards. It was to be a day that nobody that was there would ever forget. So many of those young lads were left behind. And it's not the history of the battle that I want to talk about today. No, as usual, we want to look at what happened on Anzac Beach through the eyes of the soldiers that were there. And one man who actually came and was born very close to where I'm sitting now in Northampton. How did he get via Northampton Saints Rugby Club to be fighting for the Australians on Anzac Beach? And what happened to him? We're going to find out later on in the podcast. So before we go any further, I just wanted to summarise what the wider Gallipoli campaign was all about. There were 16,000 Australians and New Zealanders that landed on that day, and this was, for all of them, their first experience of combat. But by that evening, at least 2,000 of them, maybe 4,000, some reports say, had been killed or wounded. And overall, the Gallipoli campaign, an attempt to open up a second front and try and knock Turkey, which was one of Germany's allies, out of the war, it had failed. It was a military failure. But those traits were shown there, those traits that we would see from the Australians and New Zealanders on the Somme and Passchendaele and beyond. Bravery, ingenuity, endurance and mateship. And they become enshrined as defining aspects of the Australian character, not just the soldier, but the Australians overall. A while now, the British have been trying to force their way through the narrow straits known as the Dardanelles to capture Constantinople, which is now Istanbul, and relieve the pressure on the Russian allies that were engaged with the Ottoman forces elsewhere. There were minefields and onshore artillery batteries, and they thwarted the early naval attempts to seize the straits. And that's why it was decided that troops would have to land on the peninsula to overcome those Turkish defences. Once they landed on the beaches, though, many units became separated from one another as they began moving up the complex tangle of spurs and ravines, and it was dark. The Turkish resistance remained strong, and the Anzacs were subjected to devastating artillery bombardments. By mid-morning, Turkish reinforcements had arrived, and the famous Turkish general was called Mustafa Kemal, and he was later to become Atatürk, the president of Turkey. He ordered his men, and this is what he said, "I don't order you to fight, but I order you to die. In the time it takes us to die, other troops and commanders can come and take our places." As the day wore on, the Anzacs' positions became more and more precarious. They couldn't get to their objectives on the high ground. The Turks mounted a fierce counterattack and took a lot of the ground that the Anzacs had taken. And at the end of the day, the Australian general, Sir Ian Hamilton, was advised that the Allied force should be withdrawn from the peninsula. He decided against the evacuation. He ordered the troops to dig in, and there they stayed there was stalemate, like there was on the next on the Western Front for another 8 months. The Australians advanced no further, neither did the British or also the French that were there. And in January of 1916, under the cover of darkness, the Allies did withdraw their troops from the peninsula, and they managed to do it without the Turks knowing. But we can't get away from the fact that this was a British idea. Winston Churchill was very much involved in the planning for Gallipoli. It was a complete and utter disaster. And in 1944, Churchill was, of course, ultimately responsible for the landings at D-Day, and a lot of the lessons from Gallipoli were used on those D-Day beaches. But it must have been an extremely nerve-wracking period again for Churchill. No doubt he could see what had happened all those years before at Gallipoli and was hoping, praying that it wouldn't happen again, and it didn't. Let's hear the words of that Australian veteran again and see what happened when they actually landed on the beaches on that fateful day.
We got within about 10 or 12 yards of the shore when Turks opened fire with machine gun and snipers in particular. They weren't strongly fortified there. They didn't anticipate us landing where they did, but we immediately jumped into the water and waded ashore. And immediately ahead of us were these hills, not mountains.
Were you in the first wave of boats going in?
Captain Chapman was the first man to put his foot on shore, and I was the second. I was with him at the time.
In the very leading boat?
We were the leading boat that hit the shore. Yes. The 9th and 10th actually did the first landing, although other battalions came out. It was the 9th and 10th of the first wave of the attack on Gallipoli. So we dumped our packs because we couldn't carry those up these hills, and we started climbing these things. Wherever we heard shots coming or we saw a Turk, we went after him. So within a few hours, we were completely disorganized. And at 4 o'clock that afternoon, I was on a ridge called Walker's Ridge. And Shinnak, which is our objective of taking the peninsula, was just below us. I could walk over and take the damn thing myself if I had a few extra men with me.
Did you actually come face to face with a Turk?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Not in vast numbers. They were in small bodies. We'd come across a machine gun nest with possibly 5 men in it. The Turk was a marvelous fighter. He wouldn't surrender. A German would in those positions. As soon as we got nearer to him, he'd put his hands up, but not the Turk. He was a marvelous little fighter, a gentleman in every particular form of fighting, the Turk. We admired him tremendously and became very great friends.
How can you become friends and admire and call a man a gentleman who's doing his best to kill you?
Well, we were doing our best to kill him too, weren't we? It was a war of nations, not of individuals.
Well, didn't this individual confrontation take place? Didn't you find yourself face to face with the man you were trying to kill?
Not with the Turks. We did. We killed thousands of them. Not in vast numbers.
But you personally?
Yeah.
Did you come as close as you are?
To you? Oh, yes.
And what happened? How did you feel at that time?
I didn't feel anything except that he was an enemy. He wasn't an individual in any shape or form. He was there to protect Gallipoli, and we were there to take it.
But it must be rather different to actually stick your banner in a person rather than a...
Well, we're sticking them in sandbags. It's not much difference in our training. It's much the same thing, actually. No, that didn't worry me a wee little bit.
It's absolutely extraordinary, isn't it, when you listen to those words of that man spoken in 1972. What's doubly extraordinary about it to me is that he talks about it so matter-of-fact. He talks about sticking his bayonet into a man. It was no different to using to stick it into a sandbag, which he'd have done thousands of times during his basic training. But this was, don't forget, his first day in action. He must have been scared. He must have been terrified. And he talks about it with such clarity, I suppose, is the word. It really is quite extraordinary to me anyway. We can now listen to another account of a man that kept a diary of what happened to him at Gallipoli. And his name was Raymond Vernon Baldock. He was born in 1894 in Victoria. And like so many others, enlisted in August 1914, right at the start of the Great War. These are his words that he wrote, but they're spoken by an actor.
Saturday, 24th April. Left Limnos this morning, 4 o'clock. our ship first to leave. Over 100 ships in the harbour anchored a few hours' run from landing place. Sunday 25th, up at 4 o'clock, drew anchors shortly after. Arrived at landing place daybreak when troops started to land. Heavy rifle and big gunfire on shore, shrapnel and shells landing all around us Jeep boys. None of us hit so far. Warships covering our landings. Picnic over, serious business now. Landed under fire, 5 o'clock. Some men killed landing. Snipers very bad, entrenched on a hill about 12 o'clock, under heavy shrapnel and rifle fire. Fire eased off at dusk. Very tired. Haven't had time to eat for 17 hours. Monday 26th. Awake all night. Fight continued all through last night. Fight still going on this morning. Writing this in trench. Firing eased off. Raining all last night.
Baldock himself survived that initial assault on Gallipoli. He was wounded on August the 1st and was evacuated to Egypt, where he was treated in hospital for numerous shrapnel wounds. But then we have some correspondence, some postcards that he sent home to his parents, and it's worth listening to what he says to them about his experiences.
My dear parents, just a few postcards today to let you know I'm still getting along slowly. I have not been as well as I would like to be this last week. Dysentery has got hold of me again, and it is making me feel a bit off. I won't report to the doctor, for we do not know what minute we will leave. Well, my dear parents, I will close with love to all. I am your loving son, Ray. To mother from Ray, with love. To my dear parents, with fond love, Ray.
In August of 1917, 2 years after being wounded, he's transferred to France, but his correspondence with his parents continued.
My dearest mother, just a postcard to let you know I'm in this place. I don't know how long for. Came up from Havre last night. I have written 4 letters to you since I came back to France, and the first chance I get, I shall write a long letter to you. Love to all, from your ever-loving son, Ray.
But tragically, just 3 weeks later, he was killed in action. There was to be no happy ending in this story. It was during the Battle of Passchendaele, the third battle of Ypres, that he died, and he's now buried close to Ypres in the Bur Crossroads, which is on the Menin Road as you go up towards Hoog. He was 23 years old, and you know, we can see that he survived the catastrophe of Gallipoli, but like so many others, his story is common. It's unique, but far too common. And he didn't survive the war because the horrors of Passchendaele caught up with him. And that's how he died, so far from home. Let's look at now at a couple of the stories of the men, some of the men that fell on Anzac Beach, or what was to become known as Anzac Beach. And the first one is Captain Joseph Layla. He was serving with the 12th Battalion of the AIF and was 30 years old when he died on that day. At 8:30 a.m. he led his men in advance up what was to become known as Baby 700, a feature on the battlefield. It was won and lost twice during the day, and during the fighting his commanding officer was killed and a Major Elliot was wounded, which meant that Layla was now the senior officer of his battalion. Against all the regulations, he carried with him a treasured family sword, apparently, the hilt of which was wrapped in khaki cloth to prevent it from glistening in the sun. He dropped the sword at a place called the Neck, where it was later retrieved but lost again. At about 3:30 p.m. another attempt was made to take Baby 700 by moving across Malone's Gully and attacking from the north shoulder. The 12th Battalion's official history says that Layla himself moved forward onto the seaward slope of Baby 700, where the fighting was at its thickest. Although the mental strain and anxiety which he'd experienced since landing early that morning had been enormous, he nevertheless rallied his men and, waving his arms, shouted, "Come on, the 12th! The words had hardly passed his lips when he fell dead, and the 12th had lost one of its most gallant and capable officer. The history goes on to say fire was coming from the lower knolls down by the beach. Lala stood up to see and resolved to charge forward. And as he did so, a Turkish bullet killed him. He left a young wife and a 2-year-old son. and he's believed to be buried in the Baby 700 cemetery. He's got a special memorial there because they're not sure exactly where his body is, but they do know he's buried there. Now, he was survived by his wife, who was called Hester, and they had one child called Peter. And as so often happens, the First and Second World War overlap. And tragically, Peter was also killed during the Second World War. He was serving with the 4th Parachute Brigade of the King's Royal Rifle Corps. This was during the Italian campaign. He was killed on the 11th of September 1943. He was 28 years old, so 2 years younger than his father, and he's buried in the Bari War Cemetery. Now, the reason that Lela was in charge or assumed command of his battalion that day was, as I mentioned before, his commanding officer had been killed, and his story in itself is absolutely extraordinary too. Lieutenant Colonel Lancelot Fox Clark had been born as long ago as 1858 in Melbourne, Victoria. And he'd got a distinguished military record before the First World War, and he'd been awarded the Distinguished Service Order and various other military honours too. And on that day, the 25th of April 1915, he was 57 years old when he led his men into the attack. And boy, did he lead from the front. For obvious reasons, his men, who absolutely adored him, called him the old colonel. On the day before the battle, the 24th of April, he inspected his men and he told them to rest until 11 p.m. And he told his officers, he said, "You fellows had better go and have a sleep." He then went to his own cabin, and a little later on, there was one of his junior officers came to see him and asked if he needed any service. And all he said was, "Can you check that the men were all right?" This is how fondly he thought of his men. And then they landed on the beach. He urged some men who had not been able to advance over the ground from the beach to move forward, leading the way himself. According to a corporal, Lang, there were shots from the enemy as his group waited offshore, and he said they sounded like hailstones on a tin roof as they rattled against the destroyer. He said, "We hopped onto the rowing boats as quickly as possible, and off we went towards the shore under a perfect hail of bullets and shrapnel. Before we reached the shore, we had 6 casualties in our boat, and before we could get landed, 2 more. So you could see it was pretty hot." So Clark decided once they'd landed that they were getting off the beach too slowly and they were incurring more casualties. And he literally pushed his men up the cliffs. He ordered a group to go left and silence a machine gun. He knew they'd landed in the wrong place, so they needed to move off the beach quickly and up the cliffs before the Turks could send in more troops. When they got to the top of a hill, which was called Russell's Top, the Turks fled from their trench. Lancelot shouted from behind them, "Steady, you fellows, get into some sort of formation and clear the bush as you go." He was climbing a cliff face, which was steep and slippery. This was Russell's Top. And halfway up, he was panting and almost exhausted. He was still carrying his heavy backpack. Colonel Lang came up to him and told him to throw the pack away. He replied, "No." So Lang said, "All right, let me carry the pack." They climbed the rest of the way together. At the top, they found the Turks in a trench. Lancelot called for a signaller. He sat down and started to write a report to Brigade HQ, but he was shot through the heart by a sniper and died at once. Lang said, "We'd advanced about a mile and a half due east of our landing place and found the Turks holding a ridge in great strength. So we lay down and opened fire. I was alongside the colonel and had just given him his pack and got down again when zip, a bullet got him in the body. He was dead in a minute. Major Elliot was sent for. He'd only been there 2 seconds when he was hit. Another officer came up and he was hit too." Another eyewitness account said the death of Colonel Clark is noteworthy because he was in charge of the troops. In an amazing feat, the old colonel and a handful of others clambered to the level of Russell's Top. He had moved to a point near Neck when he was writing a message and fell with a pencil in one hand and a book in the other. Shot dead. It would be a fortnight before the body was recovered and buried. And Private Cavill, who was wounded whilst crawling back to the beach, said, "I'd only gone a short distance when I came upon a touching spectacle. I was crossing a narrow road on the summit of a hill where I saw an officer sitting upright on the roadside with his back to the shrubs that grew on either side. I approached, and when he did not speak or move, so I crawled up and found to my surprise he was dead. He'd just been in the act of writing when a bullet called instant death. He'd never moved an inch. His notebook was still in his hand. while the right still held a pencil, poised in a natural position over the book. He was a colonel, past middle-aged, grey-haired, and wearing a breast of service medals. Charles Bean, the famous Australian historian, he said that Colonel Clark of the 12th was an elderly Victorian officer. He led his men with exceeding gallantry, but his career, which began so splendidly, ended with death in the first fight. He was the first battalion commander to die on Gallipoli, the only one on the 25th, and he was the eldest Australian to die that day. But he got his men off that beach, he'd led them. He'd caused the Turks to initially retreat. He'd given his men orders and they'd carried them out. And he was buried in Beach Cemetery at the southern point of Anzac Cove. And no doubt when Australians go to Anzac, they go and see his grave. A true leader, whichever way you want to look at it. A man that no doubt gave up his life, leading the men that he loved so much, into action. And we can see from those words how much his men respected and loved him too. Then there were two brothers, Frederick and Edgar Adams. They were together on Anzac Day, what's now known as Anzac Day, when their battalion, the 8th, landed at Anzac. Both were reported killed. Edgar was not seen after a Turkish counterattack, and Frederick was shot through the head. Curiously, a message in a bottle was found on a beach at Alexandria in Egypt some months later. It seemed to be from Edgar, saying he'd been taken prisoner, but this was never confirmed. His family held hopes, but eventually they were dashed by a report that arrived from the Red Cross, and it said, "We fear he is dead. He's only one of the many mysteries of that fatal landing at Gallipoli, when so many were killed and had never been found." Also from Victoria was a man called Charles Hancock, and he'd got 8 sons that served in the First World War. Albert was one of those that was killed on the Anzac beach on the first day of the battle, and tragically, his brother Charles was to die on the 10th of November, died of his wounds. 10th of November 1918, he's buried in Aberfield Communal Cemetery, extension, 10th of November 1918. That's the day before the armistice. Meanwhile, back at Gallipoli, Albert's body was never found, and he's one of those that's remembered on the Lone Pine Memorial to the Missing at Gallipoli. Alfred Humphreys had originally come to Australia from Scotland as a young boy, and he was with the 6th Battalion when they landed that day, and he took part in the fighting throughout the first day. And in the evening, as they tried to withdraw back to the beach, he was mortally wounded by a bullet that had actually glanced off his own bayonet, and he had to be left behind, and he was never seen again. And what about Frederick Milgate? He went ashore at Anzac that day with the 7th Battalion. He was last seen in the afternoon of that first day, and it was believed he was killed during a counterattack, one of those counterattacks that we talked about, by the Turks. He was just 21 years old, and when news reached Australia that he died, his younger brother Sydney enlisted, and he wanted to avenge his brother's death, but unfortunately he too was killed on the Western Front. Sydney was another one of those to die in the horrible conditions at Passchendaele, died on the 16th of October 1917. He was a year younger than his brother at just 20, and he has no known grave and is remembered beneath the canvas at the moment on the Menin Gate in Heap.
We sang, God of nations, at thy feet as we stood on that sacred shore. With a heart found pride somewhere deep inside for the sons of Gallipoli. Sang Ahatua from the place they called Anzac Cove. We gazed on to see where our home would be for the sons of Gallipoli. How still you lie, and how still the tearful sigh and the question why, for the sons of Gallipoli. We sang, God defend our free land, and for all whose lives are torn, with one voice implore no more talk of war, for the sons of Gallipoli.
But as I mentioned earlier, we're now going to talk about a man called Blair Swannell. And he was one of those that died on Anzac Cove that day. And his story is going to be told by the sports editor from BBC Radio Northampton, Graham McKechnie, who's appeared on this podcast a couple of times before. And this story is very special to us in Northampton, because this was a man that played rugby for Northampton Saints, and he was also to become the first Northampton Saint to appear not only for Great Britain, but he also played a test match for Australia too after he emigrated there. So without any further ado, let's hear Graham take up his story. Okay, so continuing our stories from Anzac Cove and One Day in History, the 25th of April 1915. I've come to once again to BBC Radio Northampton to talk to Graham McKechnie, who's a sports editor here at Radio Northampton, but he's also the official historian of Northampton Saints Rugby Club. And it's an incredible story of one of the lads that played for Northampton Saints that went from Franklin's Gardens and ended up on those beaches at Gallipoli all those years ago. What's the connection then? Welcome to the podcast, Graham, once
Hello.
Again.
Hello. Thanks
time.
For having me. Yeah, thank you for having me, yeah.
What's the connection then between Northampton Saints and Gallipoli?
Well, it's Blair Swannell. That's who we're going to talk about. And I'm particularly pleased to be given the chance to talk about Swannell because I think he is... Well, I'm not really allowed to have favourites, am I? But he's right up there.
He's your number one.
Oh, he's an incredible character. He's he's up there with, obviously, Edgar Mobbs as an iconic figure. But he's not remembered in the same way.
No, because when you mentioned it to me, I hadn't heard of him. I had to go and look him up.
He should be better remembered. And, you know, he's getting there. His reputation, I think, is being restored a bit. If you go to Franklin's Gardens now and you look at the side of the stand the above the reception where they've got these giant pictures of ex-Saints players...
Yeah.
You've got Courtney Laws and there's Tim Rodber, and right between them is Blair Swannell. His massive face now looks down on you. So he's being restored and he's in the Hall of Fame. Should way overdue. Should have been in that many, many years ago. But he's a hugely important figure for rugby in Northampton. But more than that, he was a Lion, which we'll talk about. The club's first Lion.
First British
in 1899. Lion. So if you don't follow rugby, the British Lions, British and Irish Lions, as we've got to call them, is the best of the best from these islands.
It's the really elite from all the nation's teams.
It is. Yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about that because it wasn't quite the elite back then. It was more about who could spend, frankly, 6 months off work.
Yeah.
He was an Australian international. So he achieved that. Revered in Northampton, loved in Northampton, hated as well in other parts of the world. The Australians, in rugby especially, he was a much maligned figure.
Was he too rough for them?
He was too rough. He was abrasive. Yeah. He was too English.
Yeah.
Lots of reasons they didn't like him. His reputation is still damaged, even today. There was a character called Herbert Moran, who was the Australian rugby captain, who played with Swannell.
Yeah.
Pretty well-known Moran, captained the Wallabies when they toured over here to Great Britain in those early years. He hated Swannell.
And personally hated him.
Personally hated him. And that damage that he did to his reputation, he said he was despised by many. I'll talk more about this, but he was clearly a difficult man, Swammel. Yeah. I'm not an apologist for him.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Moran said a few things after he died, which are still quoted today, which is grossly unfair, and which, well, I and my late friend John Cooksey were determined to put right.
This is the opportunity.
This
again,
is
isn't it?
Exactly right, yes.
So we talk about people winning awards posthumously. This bloke was hated posthumously then. By certain areas,
yeah. I mean, there's a real contrast between his reputation in Northampton and his reputation in certain groups in Australia.
Yeah.
Because he was also a schoolmaster, and I'll come to that in due course as well.
He did a lot, didn't he?
He did
37 years, was it?
An extraordinary amount.
Yeah.
What I would say about Swannell is that he. I say about Edgar Mobbs sometimes, he was almost too good to be true.
Mm.
That he's this
boy's own hero.
Boy's own hero.
Yeah.
Swannell is...
The rough diamond.
Yeah, he is more like a character from King Solomon's Mines. He's one of those adventuring types.
Yeah. Yeah.
He is... You can't quite believe he existed.
Yeah.
And they didn't really believe him at the time.
There's no real equivalent now, is there?
No, they don't make people like him.
They wouldn't be allowed to, probably.
You couldn't achieve as much as he achieved in a short time. So, yeah, a remarkable man.
Yeah.
So...
Where does his story start? Not in Northampton?
No, just outside Northampton. Western Underwood is where he's from. He was born in Western Underwood in 1875. He is the gentry. So Northampton Saints were founded in 1880, and as you know, is a club really built on the young men of
St. James's,
Jimmy's End, working class cobblers, most of them.
Back to back houses.
Exactly.
Still are.
Exactly right. With some gentry thrown in, like Mobbs and like Swannell. He was certainly of that sort of class. He was born and raised in the house that the poet William Cowper lived in. It's still there. Cowper's house, it's called today. Yeah. He wrote the hymn, God Moves in Mysterious Ways.
Right.
That was his big hit.
Yeah.
So he was born there to a wealthy gentleman farmer,
I
think it's fair to say. He went to school in Northampton. This is the first error you see in his story. You often see that he went to Repton, but he didn't go to Repton. And the reason his captain in 1899 gave an interview to one of the sporting newspapers and said, oh, yeah, a couple of Repton lads as well. Swannell is one of them. He's not. No. He went to Spencer House School in Northampton. It's one of those old Victorian house schools, which is long. Well, the building's there, but the school's...
A private house.
Exactly
now.
Right.
Yeah.
So he was there briefly, and then he went off to train at the Thames Nautical Training College, HMS Worcester.
Yeah.
So that was his life. Although he's from farming stock, he was destined to be a sailor.
Yeah, right.
And
not an infantryman.
Going
to sea.
He was a merchant navy man.
Okay.
And which is really the start of his incredible adventurous life. He trained, and then in 1890, so at the age of 15, he went off to Australia for the first time.
15?
Yeah, he was on the Hesperus under Captain Barrett. And he sailed on the 1st of October 1890, arriving there in January 1891. The first of his trips to Australia.
First of many, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, because this is one of the things I say about Swannell, that he's an illustration of just how much these Victorian or Edwardians travelled. That, you know, if you had the means, he travelled. And that was his job as a merchant seaman. He went to Australia in 1890, went again in 1891, again in 1892. This was his life, going backwards and forwards.
Still only a young man.
He was on various ships, the Hesperus, then he was on the President. Second mate he was in the Hesperus in 1894. And so, yeah, that was really the start of his life, was as a merchant sailor going back and forth. Mm. But his roots were here in Northamptonshire.
Yeah.
And he returned and left the Merchant Navy in 1894 back to Blighty and started playing rugby. Briefly at Hammersmith in London. He was when he came back from sea, lived briefly in London before coming back to Western Underwood and playing rugby for Olney,
which is
where so many Saints players, including Edgar Mobbs, came through.
And a club that's still strong now, isn't it?
Still strong, still a famous club around here. So he played for Olney as a forward. So I've got his statistics here. He's 5'10", 12'4". So
that's
reasonable,
a big man
pretty solid back in those days. He would have, I mean, in those days, forwards were just forwards. They didn't really have defined positions. They were just big blokes who pushed.
Yeah.
I would say you would probably have said he played in a back row-ish sort of position, a flanker number eight if you follow rugby. Occasionally he appeared in the backs as a centre three-quarter, but more often than not he was a forward. Really, that was his job.
Yeah.
He played for Olney and from there to Saints, which was a common path. 1896, he made his debut for Saints. He was capped the following year. In total, he made 116 appearances in that time, between 1896 and 1904, broken up by various adventures he went on.
Oh, really? He wasn't there all that time then?
No, he was back and forth quite a lot. Famous for many things. One of the things you will read, and it's true, was that he never washed his jumper or his trousers, his breeches that he played rugby in, never washed them.
Blimey, no one would go near him then, would they?
No, don't think they did. and you see the photographs, including the one on the side of Saints, where he's wearing a tatty old jumper.
Yeah.
It's an Olney jumper, which he's stitched various badges on over the years.
A bit like Jack Russell with his hat. It's
very similar. Yeah, exactly right. So he never washed his, allegedly never washed his breeches or his jumper. He also played cricket for Olney. And he played rugby for a team which is significant, called the Western Turks, which was a charity team. Yeah. So Weston Underwood was the village was from.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's named after them. He played rugby at Saints with his brother Richard Swannell. The two of them played for Saints a lot together. But they formed this club together. They wore the crescent, the star and crescent on their jersey, the symbol of Turkey, like Saracens do
ironic,
today.
Ironic, really, isn't it?
Well, indeed, ironic, given where he ended up.
It's coming up,
But this was a charitable team, so a little bit like the Barbarians. It was the local equivalent of the Barbarians. Mm. They raised money for orphanages in Northampton. They played a few games a year, including at Franklin's Gardens.
Yeah, which was needed, wasn't it?
Which was needed. Yeah. They played, there's these wonderful photographs, wearing generally black jerseys, but they wore fezes. I mean, they could have been Saracens. You'd mistake them for Saracens.
Yeah, yeah.
But then in some games, they played in fancy dress.
Really?
So there's one photograph where two of the Saints founders, Orton, is got a cigarette in his mouth. And because we think Victorians were terribly austere, because they weren't. They're just as much fun as we are today.
Yeah.
They're no different. Rugby players had a bit of fun. Orton's got a cigarette in his mouth. And then Teddy Dunkley, again, one of the founders, is dressed as a Pierrot. So he has a tall hat and silks. And he played fullback in that match for the Western Turks.
You wouldn't have missed him then,
would you? No, he dressed as a clown for the whole game. And I was very pleased, relatively recently, to discover a match in 1903 as the Western Turks playing. And I'd always wondered, given where they were from, if Swannell knew Mobbs, and they did, because they played together in 1903.
Oh, you've got a connection.
I'm so pleased to find that. Yeah. I thought they must have known
each other. Wonder what they made of each other.
They're very different characters.
Yeah, they are.
They're very different characters. Yeah. All-round sportsman. He boxed a bit as well at the Olney Fair. It's reported in the Northampton Mercury in 1897. It said that he was carried off home on a horse and cart because he fainted. Fainted being the word that he used. It sounds like he was knocked out. They had a booth where he had to test himself against the local heavyweight.
Yeah.
He got whacked on his head. They were all quite worried about him, but they took him home and he was fine. Yeah. Just a bad case of concussion.
Yeah.
But yeah, look, I'll just give you a couple of quotes because it's important to emphasise how popular he was in Northampton, given what I'm going to say about Australia.
Yeah.
So this is from the Northampton Mercury. It's no exaggeration to say that few men have ever been more genuinely popular with both colleagues and spectators than he. B.I. or Blair I. Inskip was his middle name. Blair I. was called, he was always a darling with Northampton crowd. No more fearless or resolute exponent of rugby has ever stepped on the field. Another quote, a fearless, resolute fighter. Good old Blair I, this is from the Independent, was a familiar cry on Saints grounds again and again as he distinguished himself by his brilliant dashes. And then Clem Thomas, who wrote a biography of the Lions in the 1950s, said, renowned the world over for his unsavoury play.
Unsavoury play?
Yes, and unusual hygiene. Swannell always turned up to matches in a filthy, once white sweater with badges and dates of all the countries he represented. His prized possession was a once white pair of breeches, which he refused to wash and wore every match.
So it started off as white and then probably a dirty grey-brown.
You can't imagine it, can you? You cannot imagine. So a very successful and a very impressive Saints rugby player.
Yeah.
But what elevates him to the next level is what in 1899 he was chosen to go on the British and Irish Lions,
as we call them. It's one of the earliest tours.
He goes in 1899 to Australia.
Yeah, it's not easy to do these tours in those days, is it?
No, exactly right.
Months to get there and a lot of money involved, and they say you needed some money behind you, wouldn't you?
So it was amateurs. It was the wealthy amateurs who could have... They were all amateurs, but the wealthier ones who really could afford to take the time off work. So they sailed off to Australia, had a lot of time on the ship, and they had a little... They had a mini Olympics on the ship to pass the time, which Swannell was a... Well, a very... I'll read you some of the events.
It's quite competitive, I should think.
Very competitive. They play... It says,
bending the rules.
They did chess, and it says Swannell first. Drafts, Swannell first.
Yeah.
Cigarette race.
Cigarette.
Swannell first. Evers second. Cockfighting, God knows what that
Where
was.
Where did they get...
Jarman first, Swannell second. The events occasioned intense amusements and was won after a hard struggle. The potato race was won by Swannell. Pillow fighting, Swannell and McKinnon tied. A desperate fight, it said. And the other things they competed over, the obstacle race, hitting the turkey, and the shoe and tub race. So this was how they passed the time.
Do you play much of these games
Not many anymore. But he went out to Australia. Of course, he'd already been there four times as a merchant seaman. Yeah. He went out there in 1899, a very successful Lions tour. They won 18 out of their 21 games. They won the series. They lost the first test to Australia. Swannell didn't play in Sydney. But they won in Brisbane and in Sydney. He played in 17 out of the 21 games.
Right.
He's got a remarkable record playing for the Lions. But as I've already touched upon, he was a controversial figure.
Yeah.
And some of the controversy came on this Lions tour.
I'm wondering how he's achieved that reputation.
Well, the Australians didn't.
The crowds.
The crowds didn't care for him, nor did the journalists. And nor actually did some of his teammates.
I was just going to say, the true test is what your teammates think of you,
well,
isn't it?
You get the impression, he complained a lot. He complained a lot about, you know, what he thought people were being a bit mean, the Queensland rugby unions, the New South Wales rugby unions being a bit stingy with some of their expenses and some of the meals they laid on.
Right.
He complained a lot about the refereeing. End of tour was marked by a speech given by Reverend Molyneux, who's the captain. And he basically used this official banquet to have a right old go at Australian rugby. He lectured them on how to play the game. He said they were too rough.
Right.
He said they was pushing in lineouts. They used their elbows. They grabbed faces.
Doesn't this go on all the time?
Well, he wasn't happy. He said the Australians used to call out the names of their opponents to put them off.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of stuff.
This is gamesmanship.
There was hints of professionalism as well.
Right.
It was a speech which did not go down with the hosts.
The hosts.
Yeah, so it only inflamed things yet further.
Yeah.
Which set up the 1904 tour, where he really made a name for himself. But Swannell wrote letters home. He wrote for the local Northampton papers. And he gives... In one column, he basically goes through each of his teammates... man by man, criticising them.
Really?
So I'll quote it here. He says things like, here is a criticism of our men. Merrill, a decent kick, but weak in tackling. Thompson of Manchester is also a back. He will play well in the future, which is very, very decent of him to say so. Dennis Dobson, right wing, a good tackler, but slow. And he goes through man after man. He likes Nicholson of Lancashire, the best wing I've ever seen. But then he just goes on and on, a decent shover.
No reflection on his own weaknesses.
Not at all.
No.
Belton is fast, but the hard grass does not suit him. But overall, he was quite mean about his teammates.
Yeah, yeah. It's not a done thing even
not
today.
Really, not really. You don't.
Well,
so yeah, he made a bit of a name for himself. So that was 1899.
Yeah.
1899. Yeah. And they sailed home.
He's 24 now.
Yeah, he came home in 1899, back to life in Northampton, back really looking for something to do. He played a bit of rugby for Saints, but I think he was bored more than anything.
Yeah. And he's not used to having nothing to do, is he?
But he didn't have nothing to do for long.
No. What's he got up to next, then?
Well, the Boer War broke out,
right.
Of course.
South African War.
Yes. In 1899, October 1899.
That attracts him, does it?
Yeah. So he enlists on the 8th of January 1900. So he'd only been home a couple of months.
Yeah.
They were looking for people like him. Yeah. The Leighton Buzzard Observer says, farmers' sons volunteering include B.I. Swannell, the Northampton rugby forward, member of the English team that's just recently toured Australia. So he joined up. He joined the 37th Bucks Company of the 10th Battalion of the Imperial Yeomanry under Lieutenant Colonel Eric Smith. And 34 days after he joined, he became part of the first contingent of 550 officers and 10,000 men to set sail for South Africa in February 1900. So there he was, 27th of February he arrived.
Yeah.
He was there through the, well, period of conventional fighting was drawing to a close. It was then the guerrilla war. I mean, I'm no expert on Boer War, but he campaigned in South Africa. He was, you know, it was becoming a difficult campaign, wasn't it, for the British. He was engaged in actions at Lindley and Tigersfontein, Hartbeesfontein as well. He received the Queen's South African Medal with four clasps. He was there for a year and 148 days in total before returning to Britain in July 1901.
So he had a good year and a half out there involved in the battle.
Yeah, involved in the action. So he came home, straight back to Northampton. The Bucks Standard said that he popped in to visit them. And quotes Swannell saying, he's very glad to get home to old England to see the faces and friends that I left behind. He said he was pleased to say he had neither been off duty through sickness or leave. He's obviously quite proud of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And when the squadron was finished, he was finished not till then. He wants to see it right through to the end. He was formally discharged on the 8th of August 1901, promoted to temporary lieutenant, though, on the 20th of January 1902 and posted to the 35th Battalion. But he didn't go back. They went off, they were due to go back as part of the third contingent, but the peace treaty was signed on the 31st of May 1902,
right,
so he didn't make it back for the second time.
But from what you're telling me so far, from what happened in Australia and what you've just written there, it doesn't strike me as some kind of shy, shrinking, violent
Absolutely
character.
Not. Absolutely
In fact, the
not.
Complete opposite.
Always looking for something to do, some mischief to be had. Because he came home.
Yeah.
As I say, he was back home in Blighty, 1902. And then comes one of the most extraordinary...
This is 1904 now, is it?
Well, no, before that.
Before that.
Before, in 1903.
Yeah.
In December 1903. Well, in fact, just prior to that. In 1903, he decides to set off to Uruguay on a gold-seeking expedition.
As you do. You wake up one morning and think, what shall I do? I'll go off to South America.
And it is, again, one of the most remarkable incidents, which you can't quite believe happened. And people doubted some of Swannell's stories, certainly after his death. And you read, you know, later life, again, going back to some of the slanders that were spread about, and people doubted some of his stories.
This is what we want.
Yeah, but he did. He definitely went to Uruguay.
Looking for gold. On
looking
the gold
for gold.
Right.
He wrote about it very recently, a couple of years ago. His great nephew found his journal to our absolute delight.
Unpublished.
Beautiful handwritten journal.
Oh, wonderful, yeah. You tracked him down.
It's a wonderful piece of work, which in Swannell's hands, with his original photographs and his account of what was a totally disastrous trip to Uruguay. It was a disaster.
He's on his own then?
No. There was to cut a very long story short, they were told by probably a scam artist that there was gold to be found in Uruguay.
Because I'm thinking more sort of South Africa other places.
Well, that would have been probably sensible. So he and a group of other young Englishmen got together, wealthy young Englishmen.
Paid a load of money.
They sailed over to Halifax, Nova Scotia. On the way, one of them fell overboard and drowned. They then went from Nova Scotia down to... Yeah, they did. And all the way down to Uruguay. Landing in Uruguay, they found no gold. They fell out with the Americans who had organised the trip. Yeah. They all fell out.
Did you find any Australians to fall out with?
He didn't fall out with the Australians this time. I mean, it's comical. Because you have... The American captain, Captain McLeod, wrote about it in the newspapers, got in first, and talks about, he said, I've never met a more disorganised and dishonest and lazy group of Englishmen in my life. He blames them for everything, whereas Swannell is outraged by this.
But if there was no gold there to start with...
In Swannell's account, the captain was totally useless, didn't know what he was doing. Swannell basically had to take over.
Right.
They split the party, split at one point, and some of the Americans who were... part of who were fellow prospectors like Swannell, ended up walking home from Uruguay and ended up back in the USA. Swannell managed to find a boat back.
Come back, wouldn't
back to Montevideo, and then Montevideo back home again.
Yeah.
Total disaster,
yeah.
But it all happened. And it's just this wonderful, colourful moment. His book is just wonderful. His journal is just full of humour, it brings the guy to life. You know, he at one point...
You feel as though you know him then, don't you?
You really do. There's one point, and he takes photographs. He obviously loves the natives. I suppose you would read it today slightly patronising, but feels very warmly towards the natives, towards his crew. He speaks very highly of black and Indian crews that he works with. And very scathing about some of the American crews that he's dealt with. Mm. He at one point goes aboard a ship, an American naval ship is nearby, and they go aboard and he eats waffles for the first time with golden syrup. And his description, he'd never had anything like this before. He was really excited. Yeah, he's very boyish.
He would be, wouldn't you?
A great character. Anyway, he got back home. He returned back right at the end of 1903. He got back home December 1903, arrived back in London, back home to Olney, and played his final match for Saints actually in spring 1904.
Right, that's where 1904 kicks in.
Right.
So now we reach 1904 then, Graham.
Yes.
And the next line's trip to Australia. I bet they've not forgotten him from the first one.
No, he goes again in 1904. So I say his final match for Saints was in the spring, and the final match because he then headed off to Australia and he never came back.
Yeah.
So he went out there for his second Lions trip, similarly successful. They played 19 matches in total against Australia and New Zealand, and they won 16 out of 19. They were unbeaten in Australia. They conquered Australia. They won all three tests. Mm. The only games they lost were in New Zealand. They lost in Wellington, and then they lost the test match, which is the very first test between Great Britain or the Lions and New Zealand.
And they lost it.
Historic moment there. Great moments. Some wonderful photographs, which I'll show you of those. It was a happier touring party, I think. But
He hasn't slagged them all off, that's why.
Yeah, I think they were more unified. And if you see the photographs, he is always this scowling brute of man in the corner. Dennis Dobson was on this tour. He was with him on 1899 as well. I'll just briefly mention Dobson because he enters rugby folklore because of what happened to him later in life. He ended up being killed by a rhinoceros in Africa. He moved to Africa. He was charged and killed by a rhino, which led to his Oxford tutor coming out with a great line when he was told, apparently, he was informed that poor old Dobson had been killed by a rhinoceros. His response was, he always did have a bit of a weak handoff. So Dennis Dobson was on this tour and also becomes infamous by becoming the first Lion to be sent off in a test match. Now, Swannell was involved in this incident.
I'm not surprised that he was involved.
It was upstate.
What was the incident? What happened?
Well, it was a match. And look, it had been simmering on this tour.
Rivalries.
There was simmering resentment between Britain and Australia on the rugby field. Mm. And in one match, the referee blew his whistle. He summoned Dennis Dobson over and, to everyone's horror, sent him off for using bad language.
Oh, blimey.
And this caused, this has caused a major incident. The captain was furious. They all left the field. They because it's a gentleman. They said
he didn't do it.
And he said he didn't do it. You don't question a gentleman, but he was sent off. And so the Lions walked off the pitch.
Really?
Caused quite a stink. They had an inquest.
So the game ended. That was it.
The game was ended. Swannell was called as a witness, and they did an inquiry. Eventually, they got to the bottom of it, and he did utter. He's a poor referee who's making some bad decisions.
Never, I can't believe there's poor referees in sport.
Well, I'm afraid to say, and forgive me for using such terrible language, but Dennis Dobson was heard to mutter under his breath very quietly after a bad decision. What the devil was that for?
What? And that was regarded as bad language.
Off you go, sunshine.
Gosh. So we got to 19... And you mentioned something then. This is how he gets to Australia then, because you said he doesn't return after 1904 then.
Well, no, he stays on. Despite making himself fairly unpopular, the crowds felt basically that he played too roughly. Mm. He was booed in Brisbane. He was accused of obnoxious behaviour. It's quite amusing.
Everyone gets booed in Brisbane.
Quite right.
It's that sort of place.
He was accused by one of the Brisbane newspapers of going down to breakfast in the hotel in his pyjamas.
At least he didn't go down in that kit he'd been wearing.
Well, that's true. They should be lucky. But that caused a real... They really didn't like that.
It was
a massive
thing, was it?
They called the police in the hotel, apparently, because he was absolutely indignant.
Yeah.
So this is, just...
I think he's done it deliberately, hasn't he?
Probably.
To wind them up.
Yeah, probably. He was described, for example, as the team's distributor of bash. So he went around hitting people. The hardest rugby playing country in the world, according to Australia. They called themselves that, but he was the most bruised footballer alive throughout that tour. One of the British team, this is Swannell himself, states that a certain Queensland paper charged him with unnecessary rough play. But he states, I need not attempt to answer the charges, the Queensland paper to which I refer. They call him in the newspaper Mr. Bounder Pajama Swannell.
That's quite an indictment, isn't it?
They're Bounder. Really going for it. It's all played. It goes back and forth in the papers.
Isn't this because they're losing?
I think there's probably something in that. I think he was,
he's got a good record against them.
Yeah, he was a good rugby player.
But then again, he's deliberately antagonising people, isn't he? That's his name.
Well, look, what he says about it, especially in terms of the rugby play, is he was consistently accused of being too rough.
But he's doing stuff off the pitch, too.
Well, look, so
turning
to be
up
fair,
in his pyjamas.
Yeah, to be fair, the Sydney Sun says, Swannell never spared the enemy on the football field. But what a difference when the game was over, all gentleness and the will to go through life doing the best he could for his fellow man. So, look, it wasn't universal. It's just some people, especially in Queensland, he rubbed people up the wrong way. Yeah. And look, what he says, he said, I've played rugby football for 10 years. Throughout that time, I have never up to the present been cautioned or spoken to by the referee, nor has my play been in any way questioned. My brother and I, when young and light, got our place in the pack of Northampton because we could tackle and shove hard, and neither of us was ever cautioned or made a single enemy on the football field. I mean, look, I suspect the hard grounds in Australia made the game was slightly different.
When they hit the ground.
Yeah, and so it maybe was a slightly
was
softer
it his
game.
Brother that I sent a photo to you.
That's his other brother.
Oh, that's another brother.
Yeah, that was a younger brother.
Just by chance I found that the other day.
Staying with Australian rugby, another friend of his called Les Seaborn, who became a great friend of his, who was associated with rugby as well, he said he was sincerity himself. Sorry, he was sincerity itself as a friend and was very purposeful and rigidly strict to duty. Having roamed around the world for many years, he latterly wished very much to settle quietly down. Right. And that's what happened. So the Lions
did he have a family then? Did he marry?
No.
He was single? He was, like Edgar?
Well, I think he was probably a ladies' man.
Ah, so he maybe had one or two
girlfriends.
I think
he did.
Moving between the lines.
I think he probably did.
Right.
But he decided to stay in Sydney. So they went to New Zealand. They played New Zealand. They lost that test match I mentioned. He came back to Australia and he obviously really liked Sydney and Australia because he stayed there. He got a job teaching at St. Joseph's College, which is still a big Catholic
Sydney.
School. And in fact, if you follow Saints today, James Ram, who plays in the wing for Saints, is a Joey.
Yeah.
So he's come through the same school. But Swannell was the very first rugby coach at St. Joseph's College in Sydney. So that's what he settled and that's what he did.
Right.
He played rugby.
Yeah, he's enjoying the social life of Sydney as good as it is now. It was then.
I'm sure. Yeah, he swam. He was the vice president of the Sydney Swimming Club. He was a keen cyclist. He played hockey. He played rugby. He was an ardent sailor on the harbour, apparently. Yeah. And he was involved in the administration of rugby as well. He became a referee as well as an organiser. He made 7 appearances for New South Wales in the light blue, and he then made 1 appearance for Australia.
Just the one.
Yeah, they toured New Zealand. They went
that
to New Zealand.
That must have felt odd, mustn't it?
Well, I think it was... Look, caps were rare in those days. Australia didn't play many matches. The main game for them was New South Wales against...
But having played against Australia
for
all those
years, make the change.
And suddenly putting on that kit, that green kit...
Well, in doing so, becomes the first Saints player to play for Australia.
Of course.
So he's become the first Saints international when he becomes a Lion and becomes the first Saints Wallaby. And... when Australia play against the Lions now, as they will next year, they play for what they call the Tom Richards Trophy.
Yes.
Because Tom Richards played for the Wallabies and the Lions. And the Australian Rugby Union wrongly said that Tom Richards was the only man to play for both, hence the trophy.
Okay.
Because there's Blair Swannell.
So it should be the Swannell Trophy.
It should certainly. And his family, his descendants, are
campaigning
hard. Not to have it renamed, because that's fair enough, but to have a new trophy introduced.
Could be the man of the match trophy.
Player of the series they want should be the Blair Swannell Trophy. So good luck to them, all power to them in that. So there we are. He went off to New Zealand. He made more enemies in New Zealand. I'll just quote some of the newspapers. The Otago Witness said he left the Dominion with black eyes extending down to his neck, with his mouth torn at the corners and minus many molars. But he still had the smile that could not be kicked off. So he played a good hard game and would tell people he could never stand the parlour games anyhow. So wherever he went, he seemed to make enemies.
He did.
On the rugby field.
But he's also making lots of friends. There's no, there doesn't seem to be any middle ground. It's either enemies or
friends. Yeah,
I think
his friends were incredibly loyal to him.
And he was loyal to them.
But I think that his Britishness offended some Australians as well. There's a quote here from someone on that tour to New Zealand. He says, Blair Swannells was with that team. When they left the boat in New Zealand to transfer to the train, everyone grabbed their suitcases and set off. Not so B.I., and when the baggage man came over to ask him where his bags were, he pointed towards the wharf saying, "Over there, I never came all this way to carry bags." And it's written in that sort of slightly odd way.
Over there. Yes. You can imagine that would irritate someone.
Yes, the Australians didn't much care for that sort of behaviour.
No, especially bearing in mind the history and everything.
He was also involved with the cadets. So his military training, he got involved with cadets in Sydney. Yeah. And there is, again, an example of the less savoury part of his personality in the newspapers. Well, Swannell gets fined 5 shillings at one point because he hit a boy with a cane.
Did he?
A cadet, a 14-year-old cadet, who, if you read the reports, this boy was playing the mouth organ on parade, and Swannell apparently warned him for disrupting his parade, and he carried on, and he hit him with a stick. And he was fined for that and was, you know, really vilified in the newspapers for that incident. Yeah. Yeah. So, look, he is, as we all are, a complex person. Yeah. He is not straightforward.
Yeah.
And
but he's the sort of bloke you want with you in the trenches, albeit it wasn't for long.
Correct. But as I say, Herbert Moran is the main source of the ire directed towards him. This fellow sportsman who wrote about this, and this is important really, because it explains a lot of what later happened, because Moran says famously his conception of rugby was one of trained violence, and that's the phrase which is used again and again. He kept himself in perfect condition, which enabled him to conceal his slowness on the field. My back was black and blue from his attentions. He looked across at me as a much younger player to see how I had taken it all. Are you satisfied? Perfectly, I replied, after which he invited me to have a glass of beer with him, a signal honour, for he was not given to treating. In life, as on the field, Swannell gave no quarter and asked for none. We less mature men stood in awe of him.
Yeah. Well, that's fair enough. That sounds like a compliment.
For Moran, that is about as close as you get.
Yeah.
The Sydney referee said Swannell was a daredevil footballer who could take a knock and give a knock.
Yeah, that's what you want, isn't it, in sport?
Yeah.
Really, you find people like that. But
he was a very hard man. He was a very, very hard man.
Yeah.
As a merchant seaman, his life in the merchant navy, and
that would have been no picnic.
He was a tough, tough man. And then when war broke out,
So he's living in Sydney.
He's in Sydney.
1914.
His reaction, it's absolutely in his DNA.
He's not in the reserves, though.
He's in the cadets, and he had served, of course, in the Boer War, commissioned in the Boer War.
So he then decides to volunteer. Because obviously there's no conscription.
He absolutely did. Yeah. He said to his friend Les Seaborn, "I have dodged bullets for 3 years, but this time I suppose they will get me."
Yeah, really? He forecast his own demise.
Yeah. Les Seaborn himself said, on the question of going to war, he went not as he might previously have done out of spirit of adventure, but as he expressed it, it was up to him as a soldier to do his duty in fights for his country. Mm. So that was very much
you do hear this a lot, don't you? Even though the country is a long way away, you do hear this a lot from Australians saying that they still have that connection with the mother country, which is one of the reasons why they joined up. But in his case, he was British.
Well, he would absolutely, I'm sure, regarded himself, as many of Australians at the time would, he would regard himself as British. Mm. So at the age of 38, so he's a little bit older, at the age of 38, on the 1st of September 1914, his service record shows that he was passed for major in the senior cadets. And that's the start of his war.
And the beauty of it is, because he's Australian, that the service records are complete and all in one place and online, aren't they? And available
to everybody. Great. It's great. Yeah. So we do know pretty much what happens to him in quite a lot of detail. And also because he was a bit of a Sydney celebrity. And again, his friend Billy Hill wrote in the newspapers saying that he bumped into Swannell in the cafe in Pitt Street in Sydney. And he said, "Blair, are you going to war?" And like a flash came his reply, "Yes, and with the first lot. If I am to be killed, it will be amongst the gentlemen."
Good God.
So he wants to be in the first wave.
He's fearless, isn't he?
He is fearless. He is fearless.
I mean, this is a different kettle of fish, isn't it, than being fearless on a rugby pitch?
I think it's absolutely. It's impossible for us to understand, but I think he absolutely felt it was his destiny to fight and possibly die on the battlefield.
Which is what happened.
So he became an officer in D Company, the 1st Battalion of the Australian Imperial Force, which became the 1st Brigade. They gave him a great send-off in Sydney.
Yeah.
The swimming club organised a big send-off for him. They had a big dinner. They presented him with various bits of silver. And then on the 18th of October, he set sail on the Afric off to eventually Gallipoli via Egypt, which he arrived on the 8th of December to train at Mina Camp. There are photographs of him with the pyramids behind him, having a great time with his friends, playing rugby, playing football, organising donkey racing, according to John Hetherington, who was a soldier out there. Sergeant Mitchell was one of his sergeants. Talks about, well, he says this, the training we went through was characteristic of Blair in all his doings. He was the most thorough man alive, as all of us who ever played football under him knew too well. No detail was missed, and as a result, he had us all up to concert pitch when the time of the landings occurred. The Major was a wee bit disappointed that we were not selected to land first. He considered we were the best of the companies and should have been given that honour. But that, again, was characteristic. He just wanted to be part of it. So, again, just giving you an idea of what a focused man as a soldier he was. They left Egypt on the 10th of April to go to Mudros, where they got ready for the embarkation. They went through the drills.
At Greece.
Exactly, the Greek island. Yeah, they left Mudros 5 a.m. on the 24th of April, bound for Gallipoli. And well, you know what happens next on the 25th of April.
Do we know what happened to him in particular?
Yeah, I can run through. I'm referring to John Cooksey's notes here.
Yep. Come on, John. Tell us what happened.
He was unbelievably meticulous in his research. But so the landings were at 4:20 to 4:30 a.m. As you know, they were on a reduced frontage. This is John. sounding like John Cooksey here. Not in the locations as exactly planned as on Anzac.
Which is probably a good thing, I think.
Yes, it probably was.
Where they were supposed to land, it would have been more dangerous.
Exactly right. Yeah. So they landed in relatively quietly.
Yes.
Baby 700 was the hill which dominates almost the entire length of the second ridge at Gallipoli. The need to secure the left flank of the landings had a direct bearing on what happened to the units of the 1st Brigade and of Swannell's D Company of the 1st Battalion. They were needed at Baby 700. That was what the job they were given to do. So they landed. Swannell and his men landed without loss at 7:40 a.m. So a couple of hours after the landings.
So the fighting's already
They're moving
ongoing.
In. It's moving in.
They're making some progress.
Exactly right. By 8:30, the companies were sent forward to reinforce the 3rd Brigade. Swannell's D Company was the last of the 1st Battalion to get off the beach. They dumped their packs. They followed the men of the 3rd Battalion onto Pluggers Plateau, accompanied by 2nd-in-command Major Frederick Kindon. So up Pluggers Plateau, they climbed up through there, and it's when they got there, they did their first rush. Their first drive. It says here.
So they're into open ground then when they get to the top.
Yes, exactly. About 10 a.m. This is still before they get to Baby 700. About 10 a.m., with Kindon, Major Kindon leading, Swannell's company dropped off Pluggies into Rest Gully to the south to scramble up towards Russell's top.
Yes.
They then moved towards the neck and joined more men on the slopes of Baby 700. They rushed across the neck. Sergeant Mitchell says, "We will never forget the rush he made, leading us up to the first rest after landing. There was no fear in that man's makeup." So
he's leading the way. Exactly.
Leading the way.
Leading the way.
Organising the charge.
Yeah.
Harry Cavill was also part of that charge. He says, "Never shall I forget the look on his face when we got to within striking distance of the enemy. Fix bayonets, charge," rang out Swannell's order. There was a flash of steel, a wild hurrah, and the boys dashed into the wall of fire, heedless of the slaughter. They were not to be stopped. So they went across the neck. Private Bertram of D Company said, "I can see him going into the action now, the coolest man in the company. You would think he was going into a football game. Huh. He was so unconcerned." As a matter of fact, most of the lads were calm. So they went up.
He's made them calm, hasn't he?
Yes, exactly.
With his leadership.
Yeah, up onto the slopes of Baby 700. Through,
which is a Turkish defensive position.
Exactly, with the Turks holding the top, which needed to be taken.
Yeah.
So this is where they were on position on Baby 700. And I'll leave his men to tell the rest of the story.
Yeah, please. please.
So yeah. Sergeant Mitchell says his end came too soon. He was, I think, a little too anxious for it. Spying a sniper, he ordered a man alongside him to shoot him and give him the range. The next thing we knew, Blair himself was having a shot and got his man. But the next second, he got one through the head and went the same as many other great, brave fellows have gone in the war. We all felt it very much, for he made some staunch friends among the men under him. Just remember that when I come back to some other words. Mm-hmm. He made staunch friends among the men. They all knew he would do a thing himself if he ordered any of them about, and they willingly do things for a man like that. Mm-hmm. It must have been a shock to all his friends here, but it was a greater one to us, as he seemed so powerful and knowledgeable and had waited many dreary months for the chance, which only lasted a few minutes. 15 minutes he was in battle for. Private Bertram of D Company said, "Poor old Swanee was only a quarter of an hour in the firing line when word was sent along that he was out. It had a great effect on the lads who fought like demons afterwards. He was a grand chap. And if I had to go into it again, I would go into it with more confidence if led by a man like him. Swannell was a gentleman and a sport and played the game like the decent fellow he was." Huh. So it's important because...
They're his boys.
Yeah. Major Kindon, who was with him, said he was a fatalist and firmly believed he wouldn't come through. After landing, we dumped our packs. He said to me, "There's a bottle of whiskey in my pack. I'll leave it to you. I shan't make it through today."
Oh, gosh.
And sure enough, that was the case.
I suppose he knew if he was going to be leading the charge, he knew that the Turkish defences would be strong. He knew there was a good chance that he wouldn't survive.
Yeah,
he must have worked that out.
I suppose, and having got through the initial charge, you know, look, who knows? Who knows?
Don't know what's going through his head, do we?
No, but I think what you would say is that I've been to Baby 700 a couple of times. I've been to his grave. Mm. And sometimes, as you know, when you tell these stories and you stand over the grave of a fallen man, there's an overwhelming sense of tragedy and sadness. And I don't think you have that with Swannell. Mm. There's sadness, of course. No one deserves
what emotion did you feel then when you were there?
Well, you kind of... slightly bafflement, but also you think, well...
Pride.
This is what he wanted.
Yeah.
This is the end he wanted for himself. Mm. Hard that is, impossible.
He had got a family at E. That was no one at home was.
Well, his
parents, I suppose, in England still.
His mother was still alive, actually. Yeah. So his mother wrote a letter to his younger brother Billy, whose photo you saw in the paper.
Yeah,
and this kind of again, it sums up, I think, probably what Swannell felt as well from his mother, who he was very close to. Mm. And he was constantly writing to her. She was very keen on sports. She went out to Australia. She was very proud of Blair's achievements. She lives in Castilian Terrace,
just in the middle of the address. Yeah.
So she wrote, "Dear Billy, I've just had a letter from Sir Gordon Reid telling me that dear Blair was killed in action in the Dardanelles. I am quite calm and serene, so don't worry. I am far more glad that he is dead than mangled or wounded."
Gosh, that's his mum saying that.
"He is safe. God bless you with love, Mother. P.S. Don't be upset or write if busy."
God, that's so different to other letters that I read from mothers.
They were tough, weren't they?
Yeah.
But the line, "I am more glad that he's dead than mangled or wounded."
Yeah,
I'm
quite
sure Swannell would have said that.
Yeah, he'd have said that to her before he went. Yeah.
So lost at Baby 700, poor old Swanee.
But his grave, they're not absolutely certain where his grave is in that cemetery. Is it a special memorial, did I read?
Well, that's an interesting question. And
did they take Baby 700 then that day?
Well, it kind of went back and forth, Baby 700.
So at some stage they'd have found it, what they think is his body. We know he was killed. We know he's in Baby 700, but he's got a special memorial rather than a defined grave,
yeah,
is that right?
Believed to be buried in the cemetery. They found his tags there after the war in the Australians when they were doing their bringing the graves in.
When they concentrated them.
Exactly. All I'd say is that in March 1916, someone serving who was from Northampton with the Australians came back and spoke to the Northampton Mercury. And he talks about Swannell. He says how Major Swannell died. He gives the eyewitness account of being hit in the head by a sniper. Yeah. But he does say this, which I do think is interesting. He said, "We gave him a beautiful funeral. He was buried on Brighton Beach, which is Anzac Cove today.
Yeah.
Around his name, we inscribed a cross with large white stones collected from the beach. And on top, we designed a cross of fuse caps from the Turkish 15-pounders. Look, it's very detailed, isn't it? So there is a question of perhaps that happened.
Yeah.
I think it's more likely that he's sparing the feelings for Mrs. Swannell by giving the impression there was a Christian burial.
Yeah.
But as far as we know, he's buried on baby 700. Look, I'll just finish his story just with a quote from a couple of people who knew him. Moran, who hated him, but St. Joseph's College said, Swannell was such a live personality that with difficulty could one picture that forceful, manly heart and active brain stilled forever. Farewell, Swannell. Your memory shall ever be green within the walls of St. Joseph's. And finally, Herbert Moran says he was early in the field and found his end storming the goal on that April morning at Gallipoli. He is still there holding on. It was always said of a Roman emperor that he should die on his feet. Swannell, no doubt, thought a footballer should perish following on. His hard-visaged comrades said he died with the ruling passion strong upon him, putting in the boots. Through sacrifice, he passed into transfiguration. For me, who knew him well, this is his epitaph. He never hung out of a ruck.
Brilliant. Thank you, Graham. So that was an incredible story to finish with there. We featured a few stories about what happened on that day, Anzac Day, what we now know as Anzac Day 1915. And we went through that man's 38 years of life, and his military service in World War One was all over in just 15 minutes, as Graham explained. The fickle finger of fate meant that he missed out on the rest of his, what would have been the rest of his life. So many of these stories, we reflect on the same thoughts, really. Now, next week, I'm going to be over on the Somme for several days, guiding some people from Australia. And we've got a number of meetings lined up to interview people on the Somme battlefield, which will make up the next podcast. But it will probably be a couple of weeks before that episode is ready to go. So all that remains for me to do is to thank Graham for coming on and telling the story of Blair Swannell. To thank you for tuning in. Please do continue to rate and review on Spotify, Amazon and Apple podcasts. And we'll end, as we usually do, by playing the last post in memory of all of those Anzacs, British, French and indeed Turks that fell on Anzac Day 1915.